get going. Hi, this is our second lecture out of three about higher spin theory. Our main business is to try and construct Vasiliev's field equations of higher spin gravity out of familiar building blocks in a reasonably motivated way. We'll see how we go. So what's happened so far is we said that, first of all, one must become boss at looking at free massless field equations, that is the linearized limit of the theory. So we started out with the spectrum of fields, one of each integer or even integer spin. So there's a scalar, and then there are left-handed and right-handed field strengths, only field strengths. We haven't looked at potentials yet of every spin. Okay. Each of these guys has the ordinary free massless field equation. The scalar is conformally coupled massless, but other than that, everything is as usual. Okay. And then our first step into proper higher spin land was to introduce a democracy of Lorentz representations, of all the possible ways to represent the spin as degree of freedom or all possible field quantities that are measurable at the point. We said that in addition to the fundamental fields, we will also view on the same footing all of their on-shell inequivalent derivatives constructed by symmetrizing spinor indices. And all in all, we get one field exactly in each Lorentz representation. And all these fields together, both the original fundamental fields and the derivative ones, satisfy a single unified so-called unfolded field equation, which says that if we know all the field quantities at the point, that is all the fundamental fields and their on-shell inequivalent, on-shell independent Taylor series, then we know the full derivative. We know how to advance to the next point. Okay. This equation encapsulates both the original field equations and the relations between the derivative fields and the original ones. Okay. At which point, we looked at the equation and said, no, it is not yet good because it has too many indices. Let's become better at it. To become better at it, we decided to look closer at the geometry of the Sitter space, which is our signature convention for the cosmological constant. So all this is meant to live in the Sitter. With some sign flips, you can move to ADS. Situated the Sitter as the hyperboloid of unit space-like radius in 5D flat Minkowski space, and identified the de Sitter isometry group with the group of rotations in this 5D space generated by 5D B vectors, which once you choose a point X under the Sitter hyperboloid, decompose into translations and rotations around the point. Okay, and then we set out to develop the spinor language corresponding to this picture, because all our fields and field equations are best expressed in terms of spinors. Yeah?
So this is all in the language where you have one of each spin, integer spin field.
Yes.
And I can, if you tell me a pair of integers n and n, where they're both even or they're both odd, then
yes,
I can write down all such phi fields and figure out which derivative of which spin field it is.
Yes.
If I were to instead think about the truncation to only even spin fields, mm-hmm, is there a corresponding rule for m and n such that I tell you all pairs of integers m and n that and back out what all of the field content is?
Well, we can figure it out. So, and these representations are the derivatives of the scalar are half k, half k. The derivatives of the left-handed guy are s plus half k, and the derivatives of the right-handed guy are half k s plus half k. And then you just pick out all those where s is even. And we can, of course, find the formula for this, saying that j left minus j right is an even number or some such thing.
Okay. So,
spinners in the sitter. So we went and defined the spinner representation of the five-dimensional rotation group, or the group of the sitter isometries, which is 4D space of Dirac spinners, and we call those twisters. Okay. Now, as for ordinary 4D spinners, we have translation matrices between spinner language and tensor language. Okay. The same happens in this five-dimensional embedding space picture. And skipped one step. So left-handed and right-handed spinners in four dimensions have the unique anti-symmetric matrix, these guys, as their metric. So similarly, the twisters have an anti-symmetric 4x4 metric, sometimes also called the infinity twister. And this is analogous, in fact, as we'll now see, contains the 2D spinner metrics. Okay, and the technical way to say why higher spin theory only makes sense for non-zero cosmological constant is that the metric of twister space for vanishing cosmological constant becomes degenerate. And we will need it a lot. It better remain non-degenerate for us. All right, so there is a metric on the twister space, and now the translation between twisters and tensors in five dimensions goes like this. So we have a correspondence between anti-symmetric, and now an anti-symmetric combination of twisters can be a trace piece or a traceless piece because there's this metric. So the anti-symmetric traceless B twister is the same as a 5D vector. Well, a symmetric pair of spinner indices is the same as an anti-symmetric pair of 5D vector indices. And that's it. That's how the translation works. Okay. So for these guys, the most important example is the generators of the 041 isometries. So yes, in a second. So in particular, the generators, which used to be anti-symmetric B vectors in vector indices, become symmetric matrices in twister space. Yes, these guys are simply the familiar gamma matrices from 4D spacetime. So running over the values of the vector index I, these are gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, and then their product, which for archaic reasons is usually called gamma 5, but of course it's much more reasonable in our context to call it gamma 4. Great. Success. Okay. So this is the story in general without picking a point in spacetime. Now let's pick a point. What happens once we pick a point is that the the Sitter group becomes broken to the group of Lorentz rotations around the chosen point. Okay? And then representations decompose. Okay? So in particular, a 5D vector, once you chose a point under the Sitter hyperboloid, has a tangential part and the radial part. Now, what happens to a twister once you choose a point on the hyperboloid? Well, we had the Dirac representation of O for 1. The only thing it can do is it can become the Dirac representation of O 3 1. OK, so at a point, twisters just become ordinary Dirac spinners of O for 1, which means they can now be decomposed into left-handed and right-handed Weyl spinners, the two component ones. Yeah? Oh, yes. OK, and this decomposition can be realized by a pair of projectors. So projector right or left-handed matrix in twister space, dependent on the chosen point x, is half delta plus minus, my conventions always involve square roots of 2 in the funniest places, times the gamma matrix corresponding to our radius vector x. Okay, for example, if we choose the point, something's very wrong with the chalk. If we choose the point 0, 0, 0, 1, so that only the fourth component is non-zero, then the tangential 3 plus 1D space is just the ordinary 4D space of the first four components. And then the projectors become 1 plus minus square root 2 gamma 4 half. Okay, and up to the strange square root 2, which is a matter of conventions, these are the familiar chiral projectors from 4D Dirac theory. Okay, so these guys are an x-dependent generalization of those. Okay. Once we have these projectors, the twister metric decomposes into a sum of them, because together they span the entire space. So the twister metric is the left projector plus the right projector. And then this guy that is only non-vanishing in the left-handed space can simply be interpreted as the left-handed spinner metric. And this guy becomes the right-handed spinner metric. Okay. Now, what happens to our generators of the Sitter isometries? Well, a similar thing to what happens to them in tensor language, of course. So in general, they are symmetric matrices in twister space. Now, that decomposes into different possibilities for projecting the indices into left-handed and right-handed spaces. So we get left-handed and right-handed, which is the translation generator. Remember that left-handed and right-handed spinner is a vector. Left-handed and left-handed becomes the left-handed rotation generator. And likewise for right and right. OK. And the last bit of technique that we're going to need is how to take covariant derivatives of spinners. So how do you take covariant derivatives of vectors, we said? Do you take the flat derivative in 5D space and then you project back into the tangent space of the Sitter hyperboloid. Well, same thing. Right? So if we have a spinner. If we have, say, a left-handed spinner, psi beta, then the way that we take its covariant derivative is we, first of all, treat it as the projection of a twister, which lives in the flat 5D space. So we upgrade it to have a twister index. We take the flat derivative of that in the direction that we want. And in the end, we project back into the left-handed space. Okay, so this is how covariant derivatives of spinners work. And in particular, an important case is if we have a twister that is constant in space-time, with left-handed and right-handed components at each point, psi alpha and psi bar alpha dot. So the components are x-dependent, because the projection into left-handed and right-handed spaces is x-dependent. So while the derivative of this guy is 0, the covariant derivatives of each chiral spinner in separately are not. So for such a guy, we will have that the covariant derivative of the left-handed piece is proportional to the right-handed piece, basically because when you move along the hyperboloid, the two spaces mix. So it looks like this. Similarly, for the derivative of the right-handed one. OK, so now we've developed enough geometry to start going back to our long-suffering field equation. So questions up to this point? OK. So the next trick in the bag of higher spin theory is to take all of our independent fields at a point and pack them all together into a single function with no indices. Because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get rid of all these pesky indices. So we can package all of these guys into a single, what is called, master field. So whenever you see one, you say, yesh master. Because we have exactly one for each number of alphas and alpha dots. So we can treat it as a Taylor series in a left-handed and right-handed spinner, which we'll call y and y bar. So we can write a sum over m and n. M factors of y and n factors of y bar. Okay. So this single function contains all of our fields at a point. However, this makes sense only at a single point, because we don't know how to compare spinners between one point and the next. We live in a curved space. But we already know the answer to this. because a left-handed spinner and a right-handed spinner together make a twister. And we know how to compare twisters. They live in the flat 5D space. So we upgrade this idea into the even better idea of a field that now knows how to depend on space-time, and the y and y bar together combine into a single twister, capital Y.
Yes. Yeah. The y's are an auxiliary space, and there's still implicitly a space-time dependence in the first equation you wrote, right?
Yes. However, here, I don't know how to write it cleanly because I don't know how to compare spinners between different points. So the first equation is really a rough sketch. It only makes sense at a single point. This form really does make sense. So this is the correct starting point. At each point x, you have a function of the spacetime point x and the twister y. At each point x, the twister y can be decomposed into left-handed and right-handed spinners, little y and little y bar. And then you can interpret your function as a Taylor series, giving you the full set of fields at that point.
Okay, that's
the Yes. OK, and by the way, in this language, it becomes very convenient to impose the fact that we are talking about integer spins only. It simply means that our master field is even in Y, because that means even powers of Ys and Y bars. OK. So we've packaged all the fields together. But how do you write the field equation? We've hidden away all the indices. Oh, how can we do the usual tricks of tensor algebra with them? How can we trace and symmetrize and all those nice things? So now comes another trick. Which will also be essential. Let's introduce a beast called star product between our spinner variables y. So yA times yB, ladies and gentlemen, is an ordinary product plus a factor of the metric. Okay. This new product is non-commutative because the metric is anti-symmetric. So this implies commutator under the star product of 2i times the metric. And this is a bit like what you do with when you construct Clifford algebra. Only with the Clifford algebra, it's anti-commutators of vectors that give the symmetric metric and vector space. And here we have commutators of spinners that give anti-symmetric metric and spinner space. Okay. So it's a super version of Clifford algebra. OK, and this product, though non-commutative, we of course like associative products. So it can be extended associatively to the space of all functions of y. Rather right here. Yes, I may use the words spinner and twister interchangeably from time to time. It's a spinner in the 5D space. A spinner in the 5D space is called a twister. OK. So So for functions, f of y, we can generalize this product in this way. So f star g is f times g, where in between, sorry, where in between we have this exponentiated derivative operator. Now, what's this beast? Well, the first thing we'll do to understand it is to split the twisters into left-handed and right-handed parts. So we will have I epsilon ddy, and same with right-handed indices. Arrows g. Okay, and now to understand what this is saying, you expand the exponent. And these derivatives all act on f. Well, these derivatives all act on g. So this is saying that f star g is the ordinary product fg. And then there's the first order term from this. So you have I epsilon df dy dg dy plus the same with right-handed indices. And then second order terms. So for instance, from this guy squared, you get minus epsilon epsilon second derivative of f with respect to y, second derivative of g with respect to y, and so on. Okay, and you can see that, of course, this is a generalization of this rule. You can convince yourself that it's associative. There is an alternative form for this formula, which is technically better because it applies to a broader class of functions, and sometimes that's the form that you'll see in the literature. And that looks like an integral. So f star g as a function of y is an integral over two other copies of twister space with an exponent. And shifted arguments. And then you can do some work convincing yourselves that these two definitions are equivalent. Yes. We'll get to that. So this algebra of functions on the twister space with this, or equivalently this, star product is called the higher spin algebra. Now, whatever is it good for? And what does it have to do with field equations? Well, let's see what this strange star product does when we try to apply it to a pair of ordinary tensors, that is, a pair of functions that sit in a single Lorentz representation. So suppose we have f that is this single monomial with m y's and n y bars. Now, and we have two of these. So we also have G. So what does F star G do? Well, it takes the tensor product of tensor F with the tensor G in all possible ways, with all possible traces and symmetrizations of the indices. Because first of all, the Y factors automatically symmetrize whatever indices you have. So the only other thing you can do in the product is to take some of the indices and trace them, which in spinner language is the same as anti-symmetrizing because it's a 2D space. And this is exactly what the formula does. So what the DDY and Y bar derivatives do is they expose an index on both F and G, and then these epsilons contract them. Okay? So the star product gives the products of tensors with all possible index structures all at once. So in principle, now, if you have the star product and you are able to pick out powers of y and y bar to get the different tensor components, then you have a new language for doing everything the tensor algebra can do. You can rewrite physics in this language. Okay. Incidentally, there's an amusing, let's call them cult, called geometric algebra, which do exactly this, rewrite all of physics in an index-free language. But instead of this higher spin algebra of twisters, they use this Clifford algebra of vectors. And then they manage to be useful only up to spin one. So this language is, in principle, useful for all spins. And this is sort of a task to be carried out to try and rewrite all of physics in this form. Now, but the star product becomes really powerful when you don't need to go and pick out by hand the individual coefficients of powers of y and y bar. When everything arranges itself automatically into the correct combinations of different tensors, and you don't need to go around picking out the individual ones. And of course, this is what's going to happen to us. So let's take the unfolded field equation of free massless fields and write it the way it wants to be written. So remember, we packaged all the phi fields into Taylor series in y and y bar. Now, let's ask ourselves, what is the space-time derivative of this master field C? Well, it will have two pieces, right? One will come from the space-time derivatives of the fields of the coefficients. And one will come from the derivative of the y's themselves. Now, this piece we know from this field equation. And you can convince yourself with the way the indices are swallowed by the y's that it can be rewritten. So the first term in the equation becomes just the second derivative of C with respect to y and y bar. So that's responsible for picking up these extra two indices here. The second term can be written as C times y and y bar. And that's all of this piece. Now the derivatives of the y's and y bars themselves, are they written somewhere? Yes, they are, because they are the components of a constant twister. So we know what their derivatives are. So what remains is to take the coefficient of y in the master field multiply by its covariant derivative, the coefficient of y bar multiply by its derivative, and we know what these guys are from the right-hand side of the board. And sorry, this is a square root. And we get minus r square root 2 c times y bar. Then from these derivatives, I dc dy times y bar dc dy bar times y. And the last piece with the second derivative. OK. Now, we look at, Now, we look at the definition of our fancy star product. And this becomes minus r over square root 2 c star yy. OK, so now without all the junk in the middle, the unfolded field equation, which contains both the all the free massless field equations and the relationship of all the derivative fields to the fundamental ones, looks like derivative of a single scalar master field equals c star yy bar. Nowhere yet. Linearized field strengths are Gaussian invariant. But it will come soon enough. OK, now I'm beginning to feel boss. OK, this is powerful. Oh, and it will be helpful to rewrite it a tiny little bit more. It can't be made much shorter than it is already. And still, because what's better than derivative equals simple product? What's better is derivative equals 0, of course. So we go and introduce a new beast into our algebra, which I'll call kappa y, which is just the delta function, the 2D delta function on the left-handed spinner coordinate. OK, what's a delta function on a spinner? Well, you can define it, if you must, as the Fourier integral of an exponent, along which contour, these are complex variables. Well, it won't matter much. This issue is going to go away in the end. So we have a delta function. And now, under the star product, it turns out that if you take this integral expression for the delta function and you take the integral expression for the star product, then the star product with this guy performs for us a Fourier transform. With respect to the left-handed y, leaving the right-handed y untouched. Okay, so we have this element in the algebra that performs Fourier transforms. Okay, and it has some algebraic properties. Fourier transform performed once, performed twice, gives the identity. Similarly, we can define the same beast for the right-handed spinner with the same properties. And it will also be important later on to have the product of the two, which is commutative and the same as the ordinary product, and is a delta function of the entire twister. So kappa kappa bar together doesn't depend on the space-time point, but the individual kappa does, because it's a delta function in the left-handed spinners, and the decomposition into left-handed and right-handed spinners is space-time dependent. So if it depends on the space-time point, what is its space-time derivative? Well, you can go and do some work and find out that it's yy bar star with itself. Okay. Now I know how to get rid of the right-hand side in my field equation. So the field equation can be rewritten as derivative of C star kappa y, that is C Fourier transformed in the left-handed spinner, is 0. Or equivalently, and they are indeed equivalent due to the algebraic properties of the kappas and the fact that kappa kappa bar is space-time independent, this. OK, so what happened here? This has a name. So we have this Fourier transform of C with respect to the left-handed spinner, and that's purely a function in twister space. It doesn't depend on space-time. The space-time derivative vanishes. So we have a mapping between functions in twister space and solutions of the free massless field equations. Okay, and some of you will know that this is called the Penrose transform. And those of you who know the Penrose transform probably know it in a different language. And now you have an exercise to show that it is, in fact, the same thing. And a hint for the exercise is that all these integrals over the left-handed spinners are really the integrals over the Riemann spheres corresponding to the space-time points that Penrose likes so much. OK, and note that, as usual in the Penrose transform, to get it, we need to choose a handedness. We either use the left-handed kappa or the right-handed kappa. And usually, when you pass into interacting theory, this becomes a serious problem. So there are two ways to overcome the problem. Either you use supersymmetry to relate the left-handed and right-handed helicities, or you do what Harrispin theory does and manage to maintain democracy between these two points of view. OK. So we should be by now convinced that the star product is smart and deserves to be taken seriously. So let's take it seriously, and let's study it a little bit in its own right. So what is this Harrispin algebra that we've invented for ourselves? Okay, so to write it again, y star y is yy plus I metric, and that means there's a commutator. Now, let's take this seriously as an algebra, and let's do what my dad would always tell me to do when I was 3 years old and would act up. He would say, now sit down and figure out what is essential and what's superfluous. And I would sit there and I'd try to sort it out, the essential from the superfluous. So from the algebraic point of view, what's essential is the commutator. The commutator defines the algebra completely. So what does the rest of this funny formula do? Well, the star product is the fundamental object. We believe that now. Okay. The y's are these non-commutative coordinates in a non-commutative Twister space with the star product with these commutation relations. But what this formula does is to define this superfluous secondary beast called the ordinary product of two y's, which is just shorthand for the commutator, the anti-commutator, the symmetrized star product. Okay, and what do we need this shorthand for? Because it allows us to express elements in the non-commutative algebra as ordinary functions. But that's all there is to it. And this is, notation-wise, this is more or less the opposite of what you usually do in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, you have the non-commutative product of operators, which you denote as the product without any stars attached. And then you may want to introduce some operator ordering, give it a name, and then you can express operators as ordinary functions of position and momentum or whatnot. So, up to the reversed notation conventions, it's the same sort of story. Okay. Now, the next thing we can do with this is we can focus on the algebra of the commutators themselves. So the Lie algebra piece of the structure. So I promised you a higher spin gauge group. Okay, this is what it is. Okay, it's the Lie algebra defined by commutators of functions living in the Twister space. It's infinite dimensional because that's the infinite dimensional set of all functions of y. Now, it has some important subalgebras. So one is the subalgebra of integer spins, which we'll be sitting in the whole time, which means even functions of y. So that is closed both under the full star product and under the commutator. Second, there is, as promised, subalgebra of even spins, which means 2 modulo 4 powers of y. That turns out to be closed under the commutator. And now, y2 modulo 4 and not 0 modulo 4? Because a field of even spin is associated with a charge of odd spin. So that's where the shift comes from. And then there's a finite dimensional algebra of only the quadratic functions, yA, yB. So these correspond under the convention we just said to spin 2. Okay, they're closed under the commutator. And of course, they simply form the De Sitter isometry group. So the De Sitter isometry generators, which, as we said, are symmetric matrices in twister space, are just these products of y's, and they satisfy the correct commutators. Okay, and at a point, there is this decomposition into left-handed and right-handed parts. So we have yy bar, yy, and y bar, which are, again, the generator of translations, left-handed rotations, and right-handed rotations. So this is our gauge algebra, and it is indeed an extension of the space-time symmetry group. The space-time symmetries are the quadratic functions, and the higher spin symmetries are general functions of y.
So what this limit does is it makes
y and y bar no longer equivalent. It sends some coefficient relating them to zero. So the left-right symmetry of the language gets destroyed, and that's related to the form of the twister metric. So in our language, the twister metric is composed of the left-handed spinner metric and the right-handed spinner metric. So if you keep the cosmological constant not normalized as I'm doing, but general, then it stands somewhere in front here. And when you send it to zero, this becomes degenerate, and suddenly you have either left-handed or right-handed twisters, and they're different things, and everything goes to heck.
To destroy this symmetry?
Well, you can perhaps maintain the actual algebra. A sensible version of the higher spin algebra. I don't know, I haven't tried. It sounds like something elementary enough that if it's possible, it will be in one of the longer reviews. But then you don't know how to construct the full theory out of it. OK, so what do we still have time for? We have time to look again at our equation for the derivative of the field strength, which was minus our I over square root 2 c star yy. And now look at it with new eyes. Because this product can now be decomposed into a commutator piece, an anti-commutator piece, and a commutator piece. Where this guy is exactly the part coming from the derivatives of the y's, and this guy is the part coming from the derivatives of the fields themselves, of the coefficients. Okay, so this is the less interesting one. It's just the fact that as we go along the De Sitter hyperboloid, the frame, the local 4D frame changes, and you need to compensate for it. And you can just rephrase the question and make it disappear. You can say, let's not move along the hyperboloid. Let's instead move the solution itself. Okay, so let's perform a translation on the solution while staying at the same point to measure it. So for a translation defined in this way, we then get that the variation of the field strength is given entirely by the anti-commutator piece. So anti-commutator with what? Okay, this is the translation generator. So it's given by the anti-commutator with the translation generator. And that's what translations do. Now, what do rotations do? Well, rotations are simpler. Rotations simply mean that you rotate the y's and the y bars at the point without doing anything fancy. And we know that that happens through the ordinary commutators and acts in the adjoint on the algebra. So rotations are realized by ordinary commutators. So our field strength, therefore, sits in a representation of the isometry group, but in a funny representation, where translations and rotations look different. And this can be extended into a representation of the entire higher spin group, which will instruct us later on how to introduce potentials. So for a higher spin, well, let's call it already a gauge parameter. Epsilon that will eventually depend on the space-time point, but is an element of the higher spin group that is also a function of y. We will have a variation of the field strength given by this, where the twiddle is telling us to reverse the sign of the left-handed spinner. Okay, and that precisely means that you get the ordinary commutator because there is no sign coming in for the rotations, which are yy and y bar, and you do get a sign flip for the translations. And this strange representation of the higher spin group is called the twisted adjoint. Well, yes. So we are at the interface here between languages. So the linearized field strength is invariant under linearized gauge transformations. But if you have large, because this becomes quadratic, twice small. But under large transformations, it will not be invariant. And of course, in the full theory, it will be gauge covariant and not invariant. Yes. Right. Very good. So we are out of time. The last thing that deserves to be said now is that from this and the algebraic properties of the kappas, it follows that the gauge transformation of C star kappa of the actual Penrose transform is just the ordinary one in the adjoint, which means that this is the field that we'll really want to use when constructing interactions. OK, so next time, potentials and the interacting theory, with the sincere hope that time will be sufficient. Thank you.